Meanwhile, the secret police, the Cheka, continue to operate, headed, oddly enough, by a former Polish aristocrat turned communist by the name of Felix Dzerzhinsky. Under a succession of later names, as it underwent institutional transformation again and again, the secret police, whether known as at first the Cheka, later the GPU, the UGPU, the NKVD, later in our times the KGB, remained a permanent fixture of Soviet life, using terror to enact the regime's demands. Through the 1920s, long before Stalin's consolidation of his regime and its harsh measures, already an estimated 100,000 prisoners were being held in concentration camps, which Stalin would later expand rather than create, where nothing existed before. A dualism of power was also characteristic and standard throughout the structures of the Soviet Union. The state apparatus, the institutions of government, were paralleled by party structures, which very often held the true power of direction. It was difficult to see exactly within the structures of the Soviet Union where real power might lie. When Stalin came to power, that question would be answered. There came, however, a traumatic major shock to the Soviet regime, and that was the Kronstadt Revolt in 1921. It was a major shock because it cut right to the claims of the legitimacy of the Bolshevik regime. At Kronstadt Naval Base, across the bay from Petrograd, on March 1921, a revolt of sailors took place. These sailors had been some of the earliest, most determined supporters of the Bolsheviks, but they had started to turn away from them as they disagreed with the route which the Bolsheviks were taking. The sailors had started to resent the harsh discipline and political repression that their Bolshevik allies had begun to institute. They now started to protest and demanded economic reforms. They demanded the reform of the Soviet councils to free them of the increasingly severe Bolshevik control and instead to recreate them as true democratic institutions. They demanded free speech, which they saw as being undercut, and demanded an end to political dictatorship. However, Trotsky, as well as General Tukhachevsky, brutally suppressed the revolt, moving their troops forward across the ice in order to take Kronstadt and to execute the rebel sailors. Kronstadt, besides being an important military event, was far more important as a serious ideological blow to the regime, which claimed to speak from the masses, for the masses, but by 1921 had crushed the challenge from below on the part of some of its own early supporters. This crisis helped move Bolshevik leaders towards a change of course in some policies, especially in economics, which came to be called the New Economic Policy, announced in March 1921, which reintroduced elements of a market economy. Now, the Kronstadt crisis was not the only reason for these reforms. Far more important was the fact that the previous policy of war communist centralization had been important during the Civil War to centralize economic powers in the hands of the state, but had proved a failure after the Civil War in trying to create economic renewal. Thus, the new economic policy changed and loosened that government control. In agriculture, in the areas of small shops and small factories, it was now allowed to produce for the market and for profit after meeting certain tax obligations of the state. What one saw on a limited scale was the reappearance of private initiative and of the market. Special kinds of people who were known as the NEP men, those who followed the initiatives and the new freedoms of the new economic policy, essentially private businessmen, reappeared as economic recovery grew as a result of these incentives. There seemed also new opportunities for outside enterprise. The American Ford Motor Company, for instance, set up a plant in the Soviet Union as a venture. But it was crucial to observe that the Bolshevik government retained control. Lenin saw the new economic policy as a temporary tactical retreat or an economic concession, not a permanent measure. In some sense, he was retracing his steps that we'd seen before in his flexibility at the time of the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk, when he had argued to his associates that it was necessary to take one step back sometimes in order ultimately to take two steps forward.